Thank you very much. May we then collect your permission? We are today meeting for the second time in the week. Yesterday we had the meeting where we considered the Competition Commission's annual financial audited financial statement. Today we are meeting with the Competition Tribunal. We all know that they work together. The other one acts like a small support, while the other one processes everything. You are most welcome, Mr. Manoy and Lerato. We also welcome CFO and the delegation from the department. The CMG, all others that are here. I'm not sure today whether we had, yesterday we had someone acting as a content advisor. Today we don't have anyone. He was here, he left. Oh, okay. Because he came to say he was sent to assist. We want to welcome back our support staff too, because at least today we can work at normal. We're not sure whether you'll be able to catch up with the work that you've done thus far. CHU was always there for the 19, the recording like that. And they will be able to assist as usual. So today we hope that you'll be able to pick up after that break. Sometimes it becomes difficult to focus when we have a break. We hope you'll be able to do so. Mr. Manoy, we will listen to you today, giving us your the tribunal performance of 2014-15 financial year. And as usual, we hope that we will be happy with the work that you do. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. Morning, Chair. Morning, members. Morning, members of the public. As the Chair said, the Competition Tribunal and the Competition Commission, who you heard from yesterday, are sister agencies. We sometimes talk of the Commission being the policeman and prosecutor of the system, and we are the court of the system. So we're adjudicative body of cases. We don't bring our own cases. The Commission brings the cases to us. Who we have today, I'm Norman Noyum, I'm the chairperson, and I'm with me my colleague, Lerato Motelong, the registrar. Apologies from our CEO, Janine de Burke, who is pushing away this week. So just to give you the how I've divided up, we'll start off with the review of the cases that we've had this year, then Lerato will deal with performance information, some highlights, and then the financial overview. And that will be the end of the presentation. If I can perhaps start off with the case review and deal with three big issues that arise in the cases. First is we deal with essentially three different types of cases. We deal with typically with merge cases. Then we deal with cartel cases, that when firms collude with one another, and then we deal with abuse of dominance cases. So what I'm going to highlight for you is in that each area we have had some developments in the past financial year, and I'll go into great detail about them. But in the merger cases, there's been a new approach to the public interest that's emerged in some of the cases. In the cartel enforcement, there's been a lot of cases in the furniture industry which you may have heard of in more detail from the Commission yesterday, and which still continue. And in the abuse of dominance, there is the one big case which is still not ended yet, and that is the case involving Sasol chemical industry in respect to the...
Sorry, Mr. Manoy, may you press again?
Okay. that worked enough. Okay. For abuse of dominance, that's when we talk about abuse of dominance, we're talking about a single firm that, without having to collude with anybody else, is able to abuse a dominant position in the marketplace. In this case, the Sasol case dealt with excessive pricing, and I'll go into more detail. So those are the three highlight areas that I'll cover. Next slide is just a slide dealing with statistics for merger cases, and we compare, the purpose of the slide is simply compare the previous year with this year. The right hand two circles just indicate to you that in the previous financial year we had 97 mergers, past financial year we had 102 mergers. We think in the current year we will probably exceed that number, possibly even as much as 110. So we're seeing a growing trend in mergers increasing and being notified. The other statistic on this page, the first graph, is just indicating how many get approved without conditions. In the previous year, there were only 85%. Past year, 75%. That's because we approved them with conditions. So whereas in past year, 15% were approved with conditions. This year, there were more approved with conditions, about 25%. What's the explanation for that? It's really what the agenda of business really is, what merger comes in and what issues are. So it's not really, you would say to me, does that indicate any change in the way we're dealing with things? Like, I don't think so. It just really comes through the door. To go into some cases more specifically, I wanted to, as I indicated, to some important decisions around the public interest. Just to remind members, when we look at mergers under our Act, we look not only at the competition issues, does this merger create an anti-competitive situation, but we also look at the public interest. And the public interest in the Act is defined as being various issues, one of which, and the one that comes up most frequently, is the effects on employment. In other words, does the merger lead to possible job loss or the potential for that job loss, which would not have arisen had that merger not taken place. Now, one of the unusual cases that came up this year was a merger involving the sale of some of the Ellerans stores. Ellerans is a firm that was sold to African Bank, and African Bank is as well known as a collapsed. So what happens is that the Ellerans division, the furniture division, went into what's called business rescue, which is a relatively new procedure under the Companies Act. And the business rescue people found in Lewis stores a willing buyer to buy 63 stores of Ellerans, their subdivision. Now, theirs is a well-known furniture brand, and you'll find their branches all over the country. What was unusual about this is this is the first time in a firm under business rescue dealt with that by us as the tribunal. And also one of the advantages for employees of business rescue is they keep their jobs while the business rescue is going on, because somebody else undertakes to fund the firm during this period. So the business rescue practitioners came to us and said, can this matter be considered on a very urgent basis sooner than would be otherwise? And so we did exactly that, and the mergers in fact saved 359 jobs and created 126 new jobs. So often, the reason I highlight this case is often business is a critic of this public interest provision because it's burdensome on business. There is a situation where in fact allow business, which was sort of the back of the queue of merger considerations, to come forward because of the urgency in public interest. So it was actually pro-business. The people who handled the particular case appreciated the fact that both the Commission and ourselves gave this priority and heard this very, very quickly. So, it's necessary sometimes to give a message to business. They say public interest is uncertain, it is a burden. Sometimes necessary to turn that message around saying, there you are having a merger and you're saving jobs. We will actually spend less time on what might have been a more protracted competition analysis in favour of the job saving that you're able to show. And that's what happened in this particular case. The next case, we're still dealing with mergers, involves, it says BB Investment Company Ad Hoc Ingram, but the BB Investment Company is really the biggest group who bought Ad Hoc Ingram after what was a hostile takeover. It was very much in the news about 18 months ago because there were two rival bidders. There was a Chilean company who also wanted to buy this Adcock Ingram, and Goodvest landed up buying it. So this case, we were happy with some raising the competition issues because Goodvest is not Adcock Ingram makes pharmaceutical products, including well-known aspirin products you're familiar with, and Goodvest is not in that market. The question was, there were going to be job losses, and the question was, were these job losses merger specific? Because Adcock Ingram was in financial trouble and would have retrenched people anyway. And the question was, did the advent of Goodvest make a difference to the employment situation? And through the case and through the evidence we got, we found that in fact Goodvest was likely to engage on a strategy for the business that was likely to shed more jobs than had the merger not occurred and it stayed under the previous management, and therefore we imposed conditions on no retrenchments for a period of 1 year because we said that the change in policy was merger specific because of this change between two different owners, and therefore this amounted to a loss caused by the merger. Because in the typical cases we've had before, the merger specific loss, you can only have jurisdiction over job losses that come about as a result of the merger. The typical case before was merger specific because the companies were in the same market and there was an overlap. So you have two companies merging and they had the same people, two receptionists, two people in this division, two IT people, the job loss was a redundancy. Yeah, there was no redundancy, these firms were in different markets. So the issue that was merger specific was the change in policy between the previous owners and the new ones. That, in a sense, was one unusual feature of this case. And the second is, had there been a proper consultation with Labor about what was going forward? And we held that there hadn't been a proper consultation with Labor, and had Labor been properly consulted, they may have been able to better deal with these issues. And that we've now said that Labor have been properly consulted about all the issues, including changes in employment policy. So in a sense, this case is one which is, in a sense, a precedent benefit to the employee side in two ways. And that's just the outcome of the cases I discussed in the previous slide. So let me go on to the next lot, operative practices. This is just a statistics slide. And it shows you, again, this start off just by comparing the previous year with the 2013-14 with 2014-15. But first, you look on the left-hand block, these are what are called consent orders. And you will see that it's roughly the same, there's a difference in one between the previous year and the current year. And consent orders, just to remind members again, are the plea bargain, as it were, of the competition system. The firm is accused of anti-competitive conduct, enters into agreement with our sister agency, the Competition Commission, to admit that we've done this wrong, to pay a penalty, and then it's brought us to approve the order or not approve the order. So we had 43 of those cases last year. The majority of them, I think, last year were in relation to a cartel in the furniture industry that's been uncovered by the Commission. Then there are, in the block below that, on the left-hand side, are statistics about the number of complaint referrals that are not settled and continue before us. The numbers don't differ too much. One lot of cases is the complaints that the Commission brings. The other lot of cases are cases brought by private parties. What you'll notice is that the majority of prohibited practice cases at last year are being settled by consent orders, by far the majority, and not that many in that year were coming as contested cases. When you see it again at the end of this year, you'll see that the trend is changing, and that we've got quite a lot of opposed cases coming through. And when I finish this section, I'm going to try and explain why that is the case, why we're seeing it. So the statistic which shows very few contested cases is actually changing very, very rapidly at the moment. Go into a bit more detail and to group, the professional that takes the furniture removal case, which you may have heard about yesterday from the commission, has been the largest cartel that we've uncovered in terms of, it's judged by the number of firms involved and their geographical structure. So when I'm using large, it's not necessarily any turnovers of the firm, but the numbers of firms involved and the fact that they're all over the country. According to the commission, 40 companies have been involved in bidding 3,500 relocation tenders between 2007 and 2012. Some of the victims of this, which have been big parastatals like ESCOM and including government agencies, national defense force, such as police services, and also private companies like TTC. How does this take place? What happens here is there was a practice in this industry that you would approach a furniture company for a quote, but you might have in your organization a requirement to have three quotes for everything. So people would approach a furniture company that they liked, and they said, give me a quote and find me two other quotes so I can satisfy my audit committee or my tender committee. And so these furniture companies would phone up their friends and get two quotes that were higher than their quote, so their quote looks reasonable. And it's a sign of this particular kind of illusion that insiders assist that kind of collusion happening. In other words, insiders who don't want the inconvenience of going through these things, or sometimes perhaps they've got a friend who knows, allow this process to happen. Instead of being their own tenders and speaking to the firm directly, they arrange for the person they like to undertake. And that's typically how most of these ones that we've got were executed. So just as statistics, we have 13 such agreements, and the penalties range small end to 39,000 and the large end to 4.2 million. What accounts for the large discrepancy between these penalties, you might ask? There are two things. The penalty is based on the turnover of the firm in the year prior to imposing the fine, and that will vary greatly, obviously, on the size of the firm. We have a cap of 10%. The fine can't be larger than 10% of that turnover. But we have a formula for how we approach the penalties, and the biggest factor that affects the size of the difference in penalties is the duration of the penalty. Was it 1 year, was it 5 years? That could be a big factor. Okay, now I want to go into our last of the cases that we've got, and that's the one you probably heard from the commission yesterday, and this is the Castle Polymers case. So, just to give you some procedural history, in June of last year, we ended our hearing, and our panel imposed a penalty of 134 million rand on Sasol Chemical Industries, which is a subsidiary of the largest Sasol group, for charging excessive prices for purified propylene and polypropylene, which are two products. These products go into what eventually turns out to be this plastic bottle that you bought at. What happens, we had quite a long case. It took some years to get to us, and the process before us also took some time. We had 21 days of hearing. We did a statistic in the annual report around that. We came to our conclusion and found that Sasol Chemical Industries contravened Section 8A of the Act, which says it's an abuse of dominance for a dominant firm to charge an excessive price. And I'll explain a little bit about what that means just now, but I'll just give you the procedural history. Our decision was then appealed by Sasol to the Competition Appeal Court, where all appeals from our decisions go. That court, which is headed by Judge President Davis, is comprised of judges from the High Court, overruled our decision. In fact, said that there had not been an abuse of dominance. The Commission has since appealed the Competition Appeal Court decision to the Constitutional Court, and that is pending before the Constitutional Court. There has to be a decision by the Constitutional Court as to whether they will take the case or not. And what's even more unusual about this case is that this is the first time since the Act has been, the Constitution has been amended, and the Constitution Act has been amended, because the Constitutional Court now doesn't just hear appeals from the Appeal Court on constitutional issues, but it has a wider remit to hear these cases. So the question is, will the Constitutional Court get involved in what are quite difficult competition issues, or what it just see as what it would be as a broader issue and get involved in a lot? So that's something we'll have to wait and see. one of the arguments about from the commission is that the appeal court jurisprudence has made this section unworkable, and there is a sense of constitutional duty to interpret legislation in a way that makes legislation work. And unfortunately, when it comes to this excessive pricing, this would be the second time that a very large case has been brought, which has ended with the court reversing the finding of the tribunal. The previous one involved the old Iskor, now it's old Steel, a few years ago, where we found an excessive price, and they sent the matter back to us, and the court could be heard by us. The private complainants have brought the case got settled violently, we don't know what the settlement was. So at the moment, excessive pricing has a difficult history. Then perhaps just explain a little bit about what the facts of the case were. It's a very fact-intense case, and it's not easy if you read either our decision or the appeal court's decision to get a grip of what was going on, because it had a certain complexity. But if I can perhaps try to simplify it in some ways to explain the issues, is when one does an excessive pricing case, the Act says that you must decide whether the price that the dominant firm charges. So you have to be a dominant firm in the first place. If you are just some little small shop across the road, you charge a huge price, or a Cape Town hotel charging this week, I think, excessive prices because Cape Town is so full, that would not be regarded as the dominant, and therefore that's just one of those things we can't do anything about. But so you need to be a dominant firm in that market, which means that you've probably got more than 45% of the market. The second is to say, well, what is the price that you charge? This is over a period of time, we have to work out what the price was during that period. The second is that the Act says a price is excessive if there's no reasonable relationship to the economic value of that particular good. It doesn't say the price or the cost of that, but it says the economic value. Now, what does the economic value mean? And the Act doesn't tell you what economic value means. It's a term borrowed from European jurisprudence. So the appeal court in a previous case on Mittal said that economic value is the price that good would have in a market that was otherwise competitive. In other words, if you were the monopolist in the market as you are in the current case, what price would you have been able to charge if you were a competitive market? And it's only excessive if that price is lower than your current price, if the relationship between what would have been in the competitive market and what you're charging now is excessive. It is not reasonable. In other words, there is nothing in the Act that says 6% or 10% or even 5 or 6%. It says the relationship between the two isn't explained reasonably. Now, that's a difficulty already conceptually dealing with stuff. So, what happened in this...
I just want to understand what's going on. Sure. Yes. Yes. If it's within the same market, or is it between the entire market?
That's a very good question. One of the conceptual difficulties as to how you get to that answer. What the court seems to be saying is that you imagine an imaginary market where it's in the same market of this good. So in other words, in this case, it was propylene and polypropylene. And so you say, imagine that if in South Africa there were a number of polypropylene manufacturers making this product, and they were all competing with one another, what might the price be? So it would be the same product that the firm is charged. But the difficulty of creating that imaginary world, which involves all sorts of economists coming with all sorts of different opinions, which is exactly what happened in this case, is what makes this so difficult. So that's your sort of conceptual problem. So one, how do you get to what this imaginary market would be? Because you don't have it in Europe. It's like getting a unicorn. We've never seen this animal called the unicorn. What would it look like if we saw it? And what economists say, well, one thing would be to say, let's start off by looking at how much did it cost the firm to make this product. So a cost would be one way to gain some sense of economic value, although that's not the complete answer. And this case would bog down on the issue of cost, because there were very different views from the different parties. And one of the difficulties was that the commission who brought the case said that Sasol's costs for making this good were exaggeratedly high, and therefore its price was seen a higher price doesn't really reflect the economic value, because in fact cattle had benefited from stake subsidies over years, and therefore the price cost difference was much larger than the accounting costs would suggest. Sasol took exactly the opposite view and said the accounting costs don't recognize the fact that we are actually selling, because what Sasol was doing was selling its own petrochemical input to make this propylene. That's what we call the feedstock chemical. And so we're actually giving our chemical division this feedstock much cheaper than we would actually get if third party came up. So there's a complete difference of opinion on this. What my tribunal, I didn't sit on the panel, my colleagues sat on it. My colleagues resolved this debate by saying, well, what did the book show that you paid for it? And we'll go with that price in the books. But there was a further dispute beyond what the feedstock cost, which was how, when you work out what the cost of the firm was and the big factory making chemicals or chemical products, what are the costs of that factory and how much do you attribute to capital costs? And again, there was a dispute between different expert people who have a different class of experts who work out how you weigh out these costs. There was a vast difference of opinion as to what the costs were, with Castle putting its costs higher and the other person, the commission, putting its costs lower. The reason being is that the real question is, what's the relationship between the final cost that you made and the price, and is it reasonable or not? So that is where the tribunal and the court essentially differed, because the court accepted the expert for Sasol's view of these costs, whereas the tribunal was a little bit more, my colleagues were a little bit more skeptical than that. As a result, when the court came to the final difference between what was the price and what was the cost, it felt that the difference was not so marked as to be no reasonable relationship between the two. And I think this view was sort of, maybe about 6% or something like that. It wasn't a huge figure. And so the court then set aside the decision of the tribunal. What the court didn't do, because the tribunal had done that, is there were also comparisons as to what price for this good did Sasol charge customers in other markets, and what was that market. We used that also, the comparison between economic value and the price, in order to decide whether, in other words, there was another piece of evidence. In other words, if you were thinking of a crime scene, you might look at the fingerprints and you might look at the blood stuff. The cost of the firm might be the fingerprints, the price in another market might be the blood stuff. The court didn't actually look at this other evidence. It was one of the issues that the commission was to raise in appeal, because it says it should have done so. So complicated story of the Sasol case and where it's at the moment. So I don't know. The commission would be closer to the slot if the appeal court the constitutional court has decided when to hear the matter. So we'll wait and see. But it's really a very, very important case for them, and given the conceptual difficulties, quite a difficult challenge for them to have to deal with as well, not something they get every day. Before I finish this section, we go into performance information. I just like to eventually mention, just out of interest, I was at a movie house and say scenes from forthcoming attraction, what's coming next. There are a couple of very important cases that I just thought that we would, I don't have a slide on this, but I'll just mention them. The biggest merger case that we'll be hearing, which is going to start actually next week, is the proposed merger in which Vodacom is trying to buy Nextel, so it's the largest mobile network operator buying the number two, the only second network operator that we've got. The merger is, what's happened is that the commission investigated the merger, they've done it for just over a year, and they have recommended the merger be approved subject to certain conditions. We have allowed parties who are opposed to the merger altogether to intervene in the matter, and those parties are variously saying to us the merger must either be prohibited or there must be much more stringent conditions imposed upon them than the commission suggested. Those parties, not surprisingly, are the rivals of Nextel and Vodacom, so they are the names that you'll be familiar with in the market. They are MTN, Cell C, Cellcom. Then we have Dimension Data, which is downstream internet market, which has concerns as well. But we also have interventions from ICASA, and we from the Ministry of Economic Development, and also from the Ministry of Posts and Telecommunications. And so altogether there are eight separate legal teams that are going to be involved in this hearing. We had actually a meeting with the parties on Monday this week just to plan hearing. It's going to take 17 days just to hear the evidence, and then we will hear arguments on the 3rd and 4th of February. It is possible then, depending on the outcome, what we've arranged with the parties, if we find that the merger is either anti-competitive or against the public interest, we will then have to consider the Commission's commissioners to be whether it's adequate or not, because it applies to address both issues. If we find the Commission is, in other words, we find anti-competitive effect against the public interest and the Commission's condition is not adequate, we will then have further hearings as to what the position should be. That's the arrangement that we agree with the parties. So what that means is that we may go beyond that 34th February date. In the meantime, just to make matters even more complicated than that, ICASA had earlier in the year made a decision. It also has jurisdiction over the merger because it involves transfer of licenses, and ICASA has jurisdiction over license transfers. It approved the license transfer subject to conditions in relation to lack of funds and to a rollout of their services. But the ICASA decision to approve is being challenged by all these same operators in the High Court. And Judge Duarte heard argument last week, and he will probably give his judgment on Monday, the same day we start this case. So that's again another possible twist to this tale, because you've got two different bodies involved in it, and then of course you've got a CASA who involves the party in our case. One of the issues involving the CASA, the High Court has decided, that the CASA decided that it would not decide competition issues when it reviewed the case, and would leave those issues to the competition authorities to decide. And the question that people are asking the High Court to decide, was it correct for ICASA to have made that decision? Should they not have decided the competition issues as well? And that the High Court wanted to make a decision about. Yeah, there are other grounds as well, but I won't go into that. So that's the big mergers we've got coming around. We've got a number of, I mentioned to you earlier that in the slide these other furniture cases, I put it out that we've got 43 consent orders. Now, that hasn't resolved all the cases. What's happened in some cases, you've got three or four firms involved. One gets leniency, one settles with the Commission, and the rest decide to contest the case. So we've suddenly got people did not settle with the Commission. The Commission is now prosecuting them. So we've suddenly got a massive spike in the number of cell cases between the people who've been, as it were, not settled, both in the and largely in the furniture industry and the construction industry. So these are the holdout people. And what's happened further, just to complicate the matter, is that in every second or third case, we're not just dealing with the merits of whether they're part of the cartel or not, but we're dealing with procedural points which have not been resolved. So quite a lot of our early agenda next year is deciding points about what access to the Commission's investigation record are people entitled to. When does a cartel end? Because that's relevant, because a cartel can only be prosecuted 3 years after it's been shown to end. When does it end? And there are various other procedural points of a more technical nature which are being challenged and which are actually holding up the adjudication of a case on its merits. That's how these things go, and that's what we are there to do, is to try and sort these things out. So you'll see when we're reporting on you next year, you'll see a sudden spike in these contested cases. It was very short in this year for that reason. So that's the other trend that we will see in the course of next year. At the moment, we don't have yet another big abusive dominance case of the order of the Sassel case before us that we've got here on our books from the Commission. But what we do have is a case that we decided after this financial year, during the current financial year, in which we found that Media 24, which is a subsidiary of the Narcissus Group, had engaged in abuse dominance by predatory pricing in the community newspaper market. We've made that finding, but we haven't yet imposed a remedy, and we will have the remedy hearing during the course of next year. Because of the provisions in the Act on which we found them liable, there are no first-time fines for that offence. So we have to give a remedy that does not involve a fine, which will be require some creativity on behalf of the Commission to come up and propose a certain interesting remedy. But that case will be, you'll hear the balance of this case and the remedy part of this case in the course of next year. And it may be that one or the other, the Commission or their party, might appeal our decision to be appealed when they never know. Certainly it was a very, very long case. And as we remarked in our decision, there's a small market in the Free State gold fields around Belcom. The size of the business and the amount of legal fees and economist fees have no relationship to one another, and this hugely falls out of cash by both sides and quite prolonged. So we may well not be the last word on this matter. We'll wait and see. So that's a sort of field of the cases, and then I can just hand over to Rolando to start some performance information.
In terms of our hearings, we heard about 180 cases and then decided to 175. The balance would probably have been not concluded in that year, and that we probably had hearings carrying on through to the following year, or it could have been at least one of the case. And large measures and consent orders made up about just over 8% of the cases that we decided on. Just the fact that we went out, that we presented about just over 3,800 job losses in the past year that they related to measures. And in the past year, we approved 8 large measures with employment conditions. We have approved more measures with conditions, but some of them would have been just competition conditions and not employment conditions. And in the past year, we also consent about 43 settlement agreements. Settlement agreements are the same as consent orders. This is the case that Norman referred to about cartels and the furniture industry, and this would be like your construction industry cases as well that we settled through settlement agreements or what is normally called consent orders. We also approved 84 measures, which is just one up a bit from 2012-2013. And then administrative penalties, we levied about 725 million. That would include the 520 odd that we levied against ourselves. The balance of that is in the past year made up mainly of the furniture industry penalties. And just to note that we now have a fourth full-time member up from 3. In terms of the performance targets that we have set, we have 18, and out of the 18, we achieved or exceeded 12 of the targets. And then I'll just give more info on the for the ones that we didn't meet in the next slide. And we spent about 91% of our budget in the past year, and also just give more information on that in the next slide. Under our strategic focus area, that is for the governance and decisions and stakeholder awareness, we have 11 targets. And out of the total of our targets is 18, and then out of the 18, we met 12, and then we have 6 that we have partially met. Just on the targets that we did not meet, under tribunal hearings and decisions, our target is to issue Thank you. target is 56%, and we didn't meet any under our intermediate measure simply because we issued only one set of reasons for one matter in that category. And that was in the Oceania Gluten's Food Corp matter. And the reason lay 15 days out of time, which is, I think the time is 20 business days after the date of decision. And we couldn't meet that target simply because of the panel workload. And under opposed to limited processes.
We want to just simplify what you said.
Okay.
What can you say? It's not a simple
message. I'm just back on intermediate measures.
Sorry, I just kind of claimed this. An intermediate merger is a merger which is usually decided by the commission. It doesn't come to us unless it is appealed. We deal mainly with what are called large mergers, which involve higher turnovers, and they come to us when we are the deciding party. So when an intermediate merger comes to us, it means somebody is unhappy with the decision of the commission, and it usually involves a contested hearing, you know, with not a run-of-the-mill case. So for that reason, what we normally do, we set a target that we must bring out after we've heard a case, we must give our reasons for our decision within 20 days of hearing the case. The reason that this target is so low, you must say 56% is very unambitious, is because we find that because these are contested cases, we wouldn't reach the target of 20 days in 44% of the cases, hence 56% is our target. However, in this particular year, only one intermediate merger actually came along, and therefore we were zero. In other words, we were out altogether with it, because it took 16 days more, in other words, 36 days, to get that reasons out into 20 days. So that's what the slide is trying to show.
On the next one, Chair, with regards to opposed prohibited practices, these are your contingent remarks, and these are the methods that MMM says, like your subtle polymer method, your media 24. These are the cases that the Commission are not able to settle or reach an agreement with the parties involved, and therefore they bring the case to us for prosecution and adjudication. In this category, what we had before is that when we reach close of hearing, but when all the papers are in and the parties are now ready for the matter to be heard, we had set up 20 business days and we should inform the parties that we can have a pre-hearing just to work out the logistics of the case, the hearing day, the exchange of documents and all that. In the past financial year, we sent out 5 invitations. And one was sent out of time, and it was issued 3 days out of the due date simply because of an administration error. And this is also one of the targets that we found is not really meaningful, and it's one of the targets that we've removed going forward, so we're not going to be measuring that side anymore. And back on opposed to effect practices, another target item we did not meet is the time it took to issue reasons after the decision. So we issued six decisions for complaint referrals, and the first oral decision was also one of the ones that we asked time, and you see that it was about 57 days out of time, so which means it took us about 157 days to issue a decision day. And this is simply because of the complexity of the issues that need to be decided in that case, and the length of the hearing, and the exhibits that were presented at the hearing. And also taking into account the workload of the members, because the members are not working on that specific case only, there are other cases, they sit in other hearings. So you don't test it and make one negative decision. There are other things going on that need to be taken care of as well. And in the next financial year, what we will be doing is that we've created sort of a classification for the company referrals that will have like a simple category as well as complex and very complex. And depending on the type of case, we also change the target as well to say, for example, case will issue our reasons within 100 days. For a complex case, we'll issue our reasons within 125 days. And for a more complicated case, we'll issue our reasons within 150 business days. And we're hoping that we will be able to achieve that. In terms of our stakeholder awareness targets, we have six, and we have not achieved three out of the six. Just to give more info on the one that we did not achieve as well, is that we aim to, our target is to put reasons on our website within 24 hours of issue. And on some of, in 14 out of 124, we were out of time, and that was simply because at some point we were upgrading the website, and so there was that downtime. And with others, is that we're not able to put business on the website as soon as we receive them, because parties might be challenging confidentiality in the reason, so we give them a chance to go through the reason, and then indicate what is confidential and what's not. And in terms of our rules, we have to issue government gazette notices of the decisions that we've made with regards to measures within 20 days of final decision. We're also not able to meet the target there, which our target was 100%, but 7 out of the 111 decisions were sent to the government gazette for printing late due to administration errors. Then the next note is the kind of stakeholder awareness, is the press releases. We our target is to issue press releases for all our final decisions, both for matters and for complaint referrals. And we have not been able to meet that target in the past financial year. 43 out of our 48 decisions show that there was little interest from the public and the media about the cases that we decided on, and in the five cases that were late, in the other five, decisions were not issued. Press releases were not issued at all. And this target is also the ones that we provide in the next financial year. That we're not aiming for 100% anymore. We'll bring it down to about 90%. On the financial overview in the past year, just to note is that we received an unqualified audit, and there were no material findings on the annual performance report concerning the usefulness and reliability of the performance information. And I'll talk a bit about the process useful and the regular expedition in the past year. We had to pay penalties of 10,000, just over 10,000, for the voluntary disclosure process. And that was the fine levied in the 2011-2012 year, but the fine was only paid in this year. This is due to the disclosure related to incorrect application of tax rates. And this is not something that affected the tribunal only. A lot of other organizations were affected by this. We also had an irregular expenditure for the project management of our case management system development over the 3 years, amounting to 805,000. And we will give more information on that later. And then there was also in irregular expenditure for procurement of furniture in the last year as well, and that was that amounted to about just over 208,000. We have written to Treasury and to sort condemnation for both the regular expenditures, but we're still waiting for a receipt from them. This next slide just shows the details our budget expenditure over the last 3 years. That in 2012-2013 our total budget was about 31 million and we spent about 27 million days, so there was a bit of an underspending there. In the 2013-2014 year our budget was about 33 million and we had just about 0.77 overspending. And then in the past year our budget was about 36 million and we slightly underspend again. And the underspending is simply because of the work that we do, that it's not possible to estimate and to spend the entire amount because we spend on what comes before us. And on this slide as well, this is just showing our budget comparing the two previous financial years. And just to note there is that most of our categories, expenditure categories have actually gone down, and I think the two that have just gone up a bit is just on personnel as well as our rental with the DPI. But on actually the result of them, our expenditure has gone down. I just went over to Ms. Manager.
Yes, can I then do as we come to the end of the presentation there, I thought what we would do is to follow up on certain prior issues. When we were earlier in the year for our strat plan, we raised a number of problems and we were looking at rather long-faced and miserable for you, and they related to these key areas. The vacancy amongst the tribunal members, the office problem which you're probably sick and tired of hearing us about, and we had specific funding problems that we were facing. What I perhaps want to do is let me jump about with the ones that are resolved, leave the ones that aren't resolved. Let me go do the issue of the office space. The office space, as I indicated to you previously, there's the physical problem where we are we are confined into a space which we consider too small. And there was also a financial problem as well because the DTI had upped the rent. I'm reluctant to use the word excessive price in relation to the rental, which was safer. But the rent had escalated enormously. What has happened, at least on the financial issue, is that our department has very kindly agreed to fund the difference between what we budgeted for the rentals and what we actually have to pay, and the DTI came down slightly. So what's happened now is we've entered into a new agreement with the DTI directly. We used to contract via the commission. All entities now are doing it directly with DTI, and we're doing it done for a period of 2 years following on what the EDB has done. So we've got a two-year rental lease agreement with them, and the department has agreed to fund the difference between what we budgeted for and what we will have to pay. So our anxiety on the financial side for these 2 years will be taken care of. As far as the physical is concerned, I'm still not certain what the position is, because I know that the department has been looking for new space to move all the entities. I mentioned last time it was not practical for the tribunal to move out alone. So the space remains a constraint on us, but we have learned for the time being to live with it. We bought, one of the issues you have seen is about our furniture, buying of the furniture. The reason we bought all that furniture is to reconfigure the furniture to fit the smaller space, so we can put double up people in some offices with smaller furniture. So it's not great, but we can live with it for the period while the EDD looks at alternatives to where we are at the moment. Then the other issue that we had was an issue around our budgets over this MTF period. And we had two problems. One was that we were worried about our budget for the current year, as done in chat plan, was way too low for what we needed it to be. That because we hadn't got the allocation that we expected from Treasury, we had to bring down our budget. We had asked for a consent, which you can get to budget for a deficit, and we'd been refused that by Treasury in December of last year. So we had to redo our budget, which is the one that you would see in the strat plan. Then during the course of this year, in the merger, we had a surplus because filing fees from mergers came along, and we also conserved our expenditure toward the end of last year. So we had some extra money, and we got permission to use that money. And what we've done is a new budget for this year, and we've been given permission to use our surplus for this year. So that's taken care of our problems for this year, and the minister signed off on that and pretty happy with that arrangement. We were also, the other problem that we indicated to you, that there were shortfalls for our 2018-19 years. And I think within the last fortnight, we've got permission again from the departments and the Treasury. We've indicated that we'll get those additional grants. So they're going to meet the shortfall that we have. So financially for this MDF period, really taken care for, and we appreciate the work of the departments in trying to help us on that and to value what we need to do. So our funding requirements problems have been solved. What still remains outstanding is to go back to the tribunal members' vacancy. These vacancies still exist. They existed since we should have our full complement of members is 11. We have 9 people currently in office. These vacancies arose in August 2014, and they've not yet been fulfilled. There's also a vacancy for the position of the deputy chairperson. In fact, we have 5 level deputies in February 2012. Now, how does that manifest itself? Well, so far we've been largely able to hear cases as and when people have been ready, but it's been quite a strain. But when it came to November, we had a problem. There was a relevant practice case that was set down in November, and we weren't able to actually hear the case, and I had to tell the parties that we have to reset it down. We'll have to hear them sometime next year. We simply didn't have enough members in November able to hear the case. So it's the first time that we as the tribunal have been responsible for the postponement as opposed to one of the parties, which is not something that we like to do, nor is it fair on the people involved. The other where we're seeing this lack of 2 members is that decisions, and you will see some of the statistics that we've underperformed, are it's meant that we write decisions later than we would like to do. And the reason for that is that what you want to do is you hear a case, and then you want to get, we hear cases in threes, and you want to get one of the panels to start writing the decision, and you want to take that person off hearing while they work up and write that decision. That would be the ideal thing. We haven't been able to do that because we needed to say to that person, I'm sorry, you were tomorrow or next day because we have another case. So our writing of cases is falling behind. And when we come to the end of this financial year, you see even unfortunately worse statistics about the delay in writing because of that. And I am guilty to be one of those parties in doing that. So 2 members may not sound a lot, but it makes a huge difference to the running of the institution. Look at this Vodacom Neotel case, going to take 3 of us out of 17 days in hearing. We can't be involved in other panels. That's a strain on our other members, of which 5 people at the moment are part-time. So I understand from the department that what the minister wants to do is to call for public nominations, and he wants to put an advert in the newspaper and to call for public nominations. The department is aware of the issue we have raised within a number of times. So that remains a logistical problem for us at the moment, which we hope secured in the next year. And I'll just go to our final slide, which is happier news. The the past and with the results of this year, but of the 2013-14 year award. We entered it in some corporate publication competition and we won the prize. So we are just showing you a little bit of details from that. So this is bragging on our part. There's a few slides from that. And nice to see that we only need to show that we might be the computer tribunal, the competition tribunal, telling other people to be competitive. We try to be competitive ourselves when we can. So it's a nice little thing. I don't know how that goes into things. I was pleasantly surprised. And credit to Nandi Mukwena, who come across before, who was our communications person and was responsible for the design and all the work on that. So it's a bit to her. So that's, thank you very much. That concludes our presentation and really questions from you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Manuel, and congratulations on the prize. We know how pressured you are sometimes with all the demands that you put. And we understand that some of the issues you cannot do without sufficient help or even the human social relations you need. We appreciate also that in this report we are able also to report on areas of non-performance, which is quite appreciated. While we also understand the challenges related to your technical nature, your work is of a technical nature, and some of the things might not seem possible to report on, but this is what you get in the smaller information, because we are able to engage and we are able then to ask much more. So I want to commend you on that thank you so much very much, and thank you for alerting us on your challenges, which I think that the committee will take up with the ministry, because we believe you are such a small institution doing great things for the country, and where possible, we need to be assisted so that we are able to members, we've heard from the Competition Commission, we've heard from the Competition Tribunal today, Marie and Paige, on the issues raised in the presentation. Can I note Mr. Atkinson and then Dr. Kari, Judge Young.
Thanks very much for the presentation. Just two questions. One was just looking at the Cecil Bolivar's case, you said up to the competition court headed by Des Davis. How often does it happen? How often what's the percentage of cases actually get referred up after you've heard them? And then the second question was who is the fourth design commissioner that's been appointed?
And
I was just asking who the fourth full-time commissioner is that's been appointed, and I see you one of the four. Who are the other two people? And then obviously I noticed in another of the issues where you had a problem with meeting your KPI, you heard to work that. Has that fourth person coming on board just to do in any way to alleviate that problem? Thank you.
I've got a couple of questions. The first one is that you mentioned in the financial year under review that you imposed 725 million rand worth of administrative penalties, I think, on companies for uncompetitive behaviour. I'm sure this is a question you get asked a lot, but where exactly does the money go? Why don't consumers get compensated for anti-competitive behaviour when they are the ones to replace, and how do you prevent companies from hiking prices to pay their fines? Is it possible? Secondly, I wondered whether you could comment on the appeal court's nullification of the ruling on Premier Foods Limited, because I understand that nullification prevents Casato and others from suing the Red Cartellus. Thirdly, if you could provide a status update on your various cases against the construction companies, Green 5, WBSO, Steph Energy, and Basil Reed over the 2010 Softball Cup stadiums. And then, allied to that question, seeking your view, to what extent do you think that collusive conduct inflating the costs of rolling out infrastructure developments has a significant impact on infrastructure developments? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just want to reiterate what you said earlier on about the wonderful work that the Commission Tribunal is doing for this country with so few resources. Chair, just that the explanation of what happened on all the issues in the presentation. But if we would appreciate that you could just provide additional explanation on this very small question that I had. We know that the tribunal can only give a penalty of a certain period. For instance, in the bid, that's the case. You impose the ban of 1 year on retrenchment and so forth, which is very good. But practically, what then happens after? What recourse does that group of workers have going forward after a year? That is the first one. The second one relates to FASA. This is a very interesting case, and we wish there were other ways, you know, of notifying South Africans about the problems that are related to the decision of the appeal court. But I just want to be clear as to who exactly is the appellant in this matter. Is it the Competition Commission? In that case, what will then be the role of the tribunal? The tribunal also going to be a friend of the court, maybe, or is it the only role that the tribunal can play? I just want to add to that in terms of the law. But let me also say that while we are worried about the verdicts of the appeal court, I think that this particular case also shows the world just how much South Africa is complying with the principle of the chair's policy, separation of state authority, because these are the judicial bodies that are waiting on this matter, and there is no interference from the state. I think that is a big point for the state. The last one relates to that irregular expenditure for the project management of the case management system development of 476,805. There was an explanation that could you just clarify how it came about and then what is then going to happen? Those are the three brief questions that I have. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions?
When you speak about saving the loss of jobs by measures, I would want clarity as to how do the measure results into the loss of those jobs.
First, it was a small but very serious.
the issue of the future person, we have not been sure since 2012. Other than the reasons it would be needed for the
transition.
Thank you very much. I think Minister, with an addition to Honourable Minister, on the issue of changing jobs, one of the conditions is you said only for a year.
Yes.
You allow the measure provided there are no restrictions for a year. Are you giving them a go ahead of a year to this person? It is not a reason enough for them to say we are having a contract for a year. Is it a good one?
Thank you. Thank you. Obviously, Mr. Manon, I think the your financial or financial performance is quite good, except for the regular wasteful expenditure. Something that where I don't understand is the condonation.
Yes.
What condemnation from the treasurer do you want? Why the condemnation from the why do you need that? And perhaps also explain to the committee the reason why some of the money you require back from the treasurer to utilize for your institution. And also, I think there was a question asked that we continually ask the committee from the previous financial year, that of the benefits for the consumer on your benefits.
Mm-hmm.
What would also be interesting is on the outcome of the appeal court around the
premium.
How is it going to affect the consumers at large? And not just consumers, but also I know that the talk about the youth, my concern is on the consumers and also the those in the agriculture business, that the condition favors before. It would be interesting to understand that. Also, I like the fact that you are able even to track the issues or to take decisions on the issues involved in outlets. Because last time when you said there's a lot of collusion and the price breaking happening, not only practice for the private sector, but also the public sector and collaboration. And the outcome of your decisions are quite clear that they're beginning to expose such. And I was just worried that in the furniture removal company, the government department are also involved. And maybe we need to make noise around that to say, administrators or public sector practitioners should avoid taking shortcuts. Because to them it might be that taking, an order or taking a quotation or quotation from one company on behalf of another company is a small use. But to others who are doing business in the same, area, they find it not fair for them. And that actually cripples the especially small medium enterprises because they are not able then to compete fairly in the market. So if it's us as government who are doing that, then it's a very wrong practice and it's sending a very wrong message. So I'm pleased to hear that also government and also public institutions are being shine a light on that. We appreciate also the, you know, this public interest issue when we put the house. It was like we making life out of nothing. But the fact that it's really helping us or it's yielding positive results, I think people are beginning to understand now. And I think we will continue to support you on that one. And we'll continue to say bravo. And sometimes it doesn't make sense for this conglomerate, like couple, really, to want to prove a case when they know that they are monopolizing the situation of the market. But because they have the financial capital muscle, they'll continue to abuse the market and the monopolization. But I think it's for all of us, you know, non-political, to come out and sing in one voice in support of our consumers. Because at the end of the day, their practices make it difficult for an ordinary person, you know, to live that life that all of us are in the future. So to put your foot on the table, it becomes very difficult by this mere practice that is happening. And some people don't understand how much it affects their ordinary person. So we really want to commend you and we'll continue to support you on those good endeavors. My only concern, as I indicated, was around the financials, and we also want to see the space issue catered for. We've been seeing this and we've been promised that the issue of space is being taken care of. We have the CFO now here with us of the department, and she knows how much we've been making to the department around this issue. I think now it would be important that we make an account in the next meeting. Tell us exactly what are you doing to this. We were informed, I must say to you, we were informed that DCI has provided more space for us by taking out some of the units or programs within the area or campus. But it looks like the challenge has not been alleviated at the moment. So we need to continue to make noise around that. It's very clear on the financial requirements, and I think it will support you, but I think you understand also the situation in the future. The finance minister is indicating that the public service demands are just too high than what the country can afford. So it is true that some countries have to fall because of that. They could not manage the wage bill of the country, so it became so higher than that even the country could not pay and could not then support other programs within. So measures have to be looked into, but unfortunately not by this committee, but it would be collaboration with other important committees like financial relations. So that is something that I think the ruling party is looking at, and I think everybody affected will have to be patient around. Thank you very much for the questions, and may we afford the opportunity to respond.
Thanks very much for your questions, and I'll try and where people have asked a question around a similar theme to deal with them at the same time where possible. Perhaps start off with Ms. Atkinson asked about what do we know what percentage of our cases are on appeal to the appeal court. I don't have a statistic immediately at hand. A lot of the appeals have actually been on procedural matters rather than on the sort of merits. We know that in 16 years, I think there was talk about BRICS conference by one of the judges, and he said there'd been 70 cases that have gone to the appeal court altogether. But quite a lot of those have actually been procedural issues that haven't been decided rather than merits. So I don't have a statistical plan, but we'd certainly work on what he did and give you that. As for the Sattel polymer case, is the first time anyone's got an appeal from the appeal court to the Constitutional Court under the new dispensation of the Constitutional Court. It's heard about two matters previously, but they were purely constitutional issues. It's the first time it's looking at the wider issue. So it'll be interesting to see how they deal with that. Then you asked about who the four full-time members are. The new member is Mondo Mzwai, and she actually was a number of years ago a deputy commissioner at the Competition Commission, then was an attorney in private practice, so she's a very experienced person to get. The other full-time members, apart from myself, are Yasmin Karim and Andreas Essels. So we have three lawyers, and Mr. Essels is an economist with sort of a long period of experience. As having a fourth member certainly has helped us, being that person in the organisation, to take some of the burden off us both for hearing matters and for writing decisions. Just by way of example, on Monday we discovered we had to have another pre-hearing, and I was involved in another one, and so I was able to phone someone's wife the weekend and say he's come in and deal with this other case, because there were seven out of us nine on Monday having to deal with various cases. And so that helps. If we didn't have Mr. Mzwai, I probably wouldn't have been able to deal with that matter then. Then Dr. Scott has raised various questions around the issue of the penalty, and I think it's come up from the chair as well. When we levy penalty on the parties, that money has to go into the National Revenue Fund. It does not go to the competition authorities. And then it's up to finance and decide where that money should go. There was a debate a couple of years ago between our minister and the Minister of Finance as to whether we could officially allocate a fine to another project in the Rose, one of the million cases involving a firm called Pioneer. And the Treasury's concern was that we couldn't make any exception around fines, because they're getting fines from all sorts of people, and fines go into the National Revenue Fund. Where money is then allocated is a decision the Treasury should make and not the Competition Tribunal, understandably. But in that case, it was a particular agreement breached between two ministers, the Minister of Finance and the Minister Gordon and our Minister Patel, to create a fund for agricultural businesses to grow businesses, and they created a fund which they set up a few years ago, which is dispensing money, and I think he has probably reported on it during his report. So it's called the Agro-Processing Fund. So that but what happened is the money was went to the Revenue Fund and then was put into the through treasury by way of agreement. So then the question is, if the money is going to the Revenue Fund, how do consumers benefit? Well, in broad terms, we would hope that if money goes back, for instance, if we've overpaid on stadiums, that money goes back to the Revenue Fund, and you know, taxpayers as a whole are compensated through that in the broad sense. In the narrower sense, for the direct victims, there is a sort of claim that you can bring for damages. And in relation to many of the construction contracts, we have given out literally hundreds. We've got to give a certificate to people when there has been a finding of anti-competitive effect. And with the certificate, they can then go to a civil court, they don't come to us, and claim damages for the overcharge that they paid as a result of collusion. So we've given out many of the certificates to many firms, which includes the various city councils who built the stadiums, and a lot of the projects involving construction involve SANRAL. And SANRAL have been given those as well. We haven't yet seen these coming to the courts. I understand, and I don't have direct evidence about it, but through indirect evidence, I understand that there are negotiations going on with the industry around these, and I don't have any more details about that, which is mainly why these things have not yet reached the courts, as an attempt to try and settle and require some creative settlements, these from the public sector victims of this. There have also been some private companies, large companies, there have been some universities, interestingly enough, who've also been victim of that. They've been given certificates. I don't know what their decisions are. They don't need to notify us. We give them a certificate and they get on with it. So how they proceed with it, I don't know. That relates then directly to the case that Dr. Carter and you asked as well, Chair, around this premier case. What happened was that there was a cartel involving the various bread companies, and certain of the bread companies got leniency from the commission, and the premier was one of those companies, came forward and gave information about the other companies. And when the commission gives it leniency, it says, we will give you immunity, we will not ask for a fine against you. So at the time that it was in this case, premier was not mentioned as a respondent in this case, so we dealt with the other firms involved, which included Tiger Brands, included Pioneer, but not Premier. So when a finding was made by us, we found that it had been part of the cartel. The question was whether our finding that they were part of the cartel, but they were not respondent to it, that the purpose of the act of finding had been made against them for us issuing certificates. What then happened is after we concluded the case, I was approached by lawyers acting for trade unions and various civic organisations to issue a certificate against Premier. And then Premier indicated that they didn't think that I should issue the certificate. So I asked the parties to come and argue the point before me. And before I could actually hear the matter, it was taken to, Premier took the matter to the High Court to ask for an interdict that I couldn't issue the certificate. The High Court decided that Judge Collins decided that I could issue that certificate. Premier then appealed that decision to the Supreme Court of Appeal, which 2 weeks ago, whenever it was, overturned Judge Collins' decision and said because Premier hadn't actually been a respondent in that case, no finding could be made against him technically. That decision may well be appealed again. I'm not sure that is being driven by the Lawyers Act or the plaintiffs to whether they will take a appeal to the Constitutional Court about that. So that's bypassed our constitutional appeal from that route. So I'm not sure what the final outcome will be. But how are we dealing with that situation going forward? Well, now what the Commission does, if you're the leniency applicant, it gives you only conditional leniency, and is now entering into consent orders which don't contain a fine against that firm. But on the basis of the consent order, there is technically a finding against the firm. That's where the premier case differs. And so going forward, it's not likely to be a problem. So I think what we're dealing with here is a historical problem. That from practice may not arise again, but it may well be that if the SCA's decision is that the Constitutional Court might agree with Judge Cotton and not them. It's a very technical reading of language. Has there been a finding they were to respond to the case? You know, Premier said it hadn't, the Commission who were involved in that case which said it had. Then I was just asked about what's happening with the other construction cases. Certain firms on the stadium have actually settled, in which case all have been given immunity. Certain cases are still pending before us, which haven't been resolved, with some of these alleged to be part of the stadium collusion, but denies either involvement or some facts, and those are still being heard. So we still have a number of construction cases. Related to Group 5 in particular, we have actually another case involving road building projects, and we had to decide actually a procedural point. They based the points about whether they entitled to the Commission's docket on. So there are a lot of construction cases that are still pending. The Commission says, announced a few weeks ago, that it has referred all cases that will in the construction industry to us and decided which ones not, it won't proceed with. But they are still at what we call the pleading stages, where people are filing their answers, so they're not yet right for hearing with us yet. You know, what would be the effect on the infrastructure development? I think one of the problems is that it meant that we have paid too much for infrastructure and then we should have there been a competitive market. And I think one of the solutions that may be looked at is to say to the industry, if you want this work in the future, you have to give back. I think that's the sort of one of the issues in negotiations. But we're not involved in that side of it, so we can't say much more on that. But the implication is that we're paying too much for a lot of infrastructure, the stadiums being one of them, and the roads, and the vast stretches of roads. Then just on to Fiona's point was asking about what would happen in, say, a case where we put a moratorium on retrenchments. Generally, we haven't said to people that you'd never retrench anybody forever, because that would be too burdensome on a firm and disproportional. So we try to look at, we try to deal with employment loss. In other words, this is a situation where the employer is saying, I've merged, there are surplus people to my business needs. What happens to them? So what we've done is to say there should be a moratorium to allow people within that period the time to find other opportunities if they can do so, and to lessen the shock of that employment loss from those people. Perhaps in 2 years, the firm's fortunes may change and may redecide. Look, firms have come to us and said, we think we may have to retrench, but if business improves, we won't retrench people at all. So the moratorium, as it were, protects workers during that short period, and also allows an opportunity when there may be a change in fortunes in the firm, may get more business and those people keep their job. That stops the immediate adverse public interest effect. The period of the moratorium, although in VidVest it was 1 year, they've sometimes been 3 years and depends on the facts of each case. In VidVest, the reason it's the shorter is that we put a ban on all retrenchments of all workers. Usually it says retrenchments of merger that arise because of the merger. I think that leads to Mr. Zika's point is, why do mergers lead to retrenchments? Usually it's because there is a duplication. The two firms are in the same market, and they've got two or three of everything, and they don't want to get economies of scale by, they say, these jobs are redundant. That's why. So we can look at retrenchments from the point of merger specificity. Then the question is, what happens if at the end of the moratorium? At the end of the moratorium, our order doesn't protect the workers, but ordinary labour laws still would. So they're not deprived of their labour law rights. It's simply the Competition Act barring that situation ends, but labour law, ordinary labour law and their retrenchments would still have to apply in that situation to those workers. In the Sasol case, I was asked who is the appellant. It's the Competition Commission of Europeans. It was Sasol who appealed to the Competition Appeal Court, and the appeal to the Constitutional Court is coming from the Competition Commission. We are not involved ourselves in the appeals simply because it's a normal court thing. A lower adjudicative institution is not involved on the decision of the higher. They have the benefit of our readings. We can't add anything more to that. So the public is, as it were, being looked after by the Commission. Its job, it has a legal team, it's got a very good legal team, and they are there to argue the matter. But our readings are there, they are available to both the Appeal Court and the Constitutional Court. They want to look at them. Come back later to the financial ones. Those are on the cases as well. So I just go back to the issue of damages, which I may not fully explain. So consumers can bring a case for damages for a cartel or any other anti-competitive overcharge. And the courts have recently recognized that consumers can also bring class action, which is actually Premier lost an earlier case around class action. So one of the difficulties for consumers, if you were a bread consumer, you were not going to go to court against the bread company because you couldn't afford it. But if you could bring a class action, then thousands of consumers benefit from that, and pursue the company, and damages are brought on behalf of the cost. So the class action has actually been really clarified as a result of competition law. It's now benefiting these cases, might benefit miners in the cirrhosis image because the case law around that has been developed in the Competition Act. So the class action does exist, so consumers have won one victory. The one they lost in Premier, I think, is historic, and this is not necessarily going to be a problem that we'll see again, but I suspect that given that litigation, that the FCA's decision may well go to the Constitutional Court and come to a different verdict. If it isn't reversed, it means in that particular case, that class of people who are suing Premier won't have a remedy. But an interesting question is whether even people who bought Premier bread could sue the other bread makers who we did make a finding against the damages they suffered as a joint liability. That's an open legal question that hasn't been resolved yet. So they may still have action in that respect. Just to then go on to the financial issues and the irregular expenditure. The irregular expenditure asked on the project management was about the employment of a particular consultant that he did to do some work around the an IT project, and we extended that contract beyond its initial terms. We were of the view, because the Treasury regulations say that it's a continuation of a previous work, what they call single source sketch, and you can carry on with that consultant. There's a Treasury guideline on that. We can just get that slide up with that language. And I, the accounting officer, applied that to extend that contract. The people who did the audits were of the view that we should have not gone that single source and we should re-tender it again. So there was a difference in the interpretation as to whether this was justified single source continuation of the same person. It's the end of a project which we saw as continuous, and then saying, well, there was a break within this project and you should tender it again and you didn't do that. I mean, one of the reasons that we thought that continuation was cheaper for us is that each time you re-tender, and we're a very small organization, our key management people involved, Larata and Janine the clerk, have to be involved in getting the tender spec, interviewing the people, and then deciding if we award it to a new person. That is a cost that you don't see on the balance sheet, and those are our people who work on a full-time basis. So that is why we saw the continuation of the same person as justifiable. The Auditor General's office disagreed with us, and hence that's the finding, that is what that's about. Then, Chair, you asked us about condonation. Apparently when this happens, we have to apply to Treasury to condone that expenditure and the balance of the contract that is available. We have written that letter to Treasury, they have acknowledged that, and we asked before we came here when we could have they can take a different view indeed, as I understand it, to the Auditor General, because we gave our justification. And we asked when they may conclude that, and they said, look, they look at these issues towards the end of the year. They're not in a position to give us an answer now. So we hope by the end of this calendar year we'll get an answer from them. I should just emphasize the point I think that the deviation can be authorized by the accounting authority in the institution. So they can condone the way I've made that decision. That's what I understand is doing that condemnation function. So the letter has been written, it's on all clean acknowledged, that they should look, don't spill that. We deal with a number of these things at the end of the year. So we can't give you much more than that at the moment. Chair, you made a point, but I just get back to the point about the collusion thing, which I haven't dealt with. I think there's some, I actually have thought of previously, you know, we often asked about what are the conferences, how are people excluded from the economy? And I think the point that you've made is an important one, is when you have people who are lazy about tenders, and don't do tenders, and you allow this to be rigged, what you do is exclude the business firm, who you may not know of, but could actually win that tender. And if you look at something like the furniture industry, typically an industry where small businesses can start up and provide a service, but you don't know about them because you don't call the tenders. They could have won those tenders, and that way they end up being excluded from business, particularly business by state. So I think the very important point is it's not simply that we always look at from, well, we paid too much because there was a rigged bid, and that's true. But there's also another price, is that people who could have got that business were excluded and were kept out of the economy, and I think that's, you know, there are two sets of damages that we must think about. So I think thanks for raising that point, and it's an important one which we must always bear in mind. In relation to the space issue, we ourselves haven't been given any more space, so we're still within the same space we have. All we're trying to do, and that was why we have to buy more furniture, to try and organise that space better. So some people have a single office, we've doubled up a lot of our case managers, and some people have to work from home. So this is why I mentioned, as our new member, we don't have an office for her. She works from home, or she will share an office with one of the other members when she comes in. It's not a desirable situation because we actually want the people around, particularly when we are discussing cases and trying to get a colleague's view. Not a desirable situation, but that's what we've got at the moment. sorry, Chair, I haven't dealt with the surplus issue that you've raised. So Chair, I think that for the forthcoming NTFA, the reason the tribunal has had a historic problem which we are, I think, going to try and deal with is that we've always relied on because we get some income as well, and we're just not strained expenditure. We've tended not to ask for our full amount. You know, look for our expenditure, this is what we've got to get in, and then deduct what we think we're going to get in income, and we've ended up with a skewed outcome. I think what we want to try and do is, going into the next NTF period, is to flatten out our expenditure side and make sure that our treasury grant keeps in line with that. Because historically, what has happened is that we'd ask for a treasury grant of this amount for one NTF period, less than the other because we have surpluses. So I think what we created problems for everybody, including ourselves. So we're going to move away from the practice going into the other ones and actually try and give Treasury a consistent amount that will increase by, you know, the normal inflation. And where we've got surpluses, we accumulated them that high, and then we'll either get a direction to pay them over or they will let us keep them. But as we pointed out before, the income depends on how many mergers come in. And the mergers fluctuate, so they're quite second. At the moment we're getting quite a lot of mergers, we're going through a bit of a merger wave, but the next year or so it could change. It's inconsistent. Thanks, Jane.
Thank you very much. And I guess
Mark
will come if he gets education about your life and the question. So I think my first question. I think we did get the internal report or the conflict, unless we have follow up.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I missed this question because I wanted to ask it together with the other questions. I'm on slide 39, staff training. We appreciate the fact that the tribunal is spending $1,337,000 on the training of the staff. This is positive, although we see it is slightly lower than the previous financial year. The question that I want to ask the chairperson, I hope I'll be able to construct the correct wording. We are aware that the tribunal is driven by highly professional people. Skill. But I'm trying to look ahead in years to come. How do we ensure that the skills, for instance, of the church, the skills are retained, but not just retained for the sake of retaining, but retaining them within the transformative aspects. So it also begins to cascade to some of the people who previously did not have opportunities. How do we ensure that the staff training fund links to the process of also ensuring that we invest in the future, that some blessed are also beginning, they are also being trained to move into the upper echelons of the structure so that the lives of Mrs. Ntawu, they themselves in future, not now, can also be seen to be engaging in that outside mode as mobile. So I think we've had this question before, but we're trying to ask it differently. We see all the professional work that is going on there, but if the chairperson could also inform us as to what the strategy is in terms of ensuring that in future, less as well, to get the opportunity to lead some of the institutions. I hope I've not used good words, but I'm trying to look at the transformation agenda of the tribunal. Thank you.
Yeah, I look at the chapter for the main of the
There was two aspects to your question. The first one was on slide 29. There is a, what is the reason for decline in our expenditure on stock training? The reason was because, as I indicated earlier, we were worried about budgets for this current year. And so at the end of last year, the areas that we could cut back on, and we didn't want to retrench anybody, were to reduce the amounts we spent on training. So it wasn't a happy decision that we made. But now that we've rectified that, staff training amounts will be back to where we budgeted. So I should distinguish between the tribunal members and the case managers who are involved in the substantive issues on our institution and other people who retain the skills around the administrative skills, the financial skills, and the running of the institution. So the only area we cut back last time around was around administrative training staff, and we will in the future back to where we normally were now that we've got the money that we wanted. So it's a historic problem, it's unfortunate as you put out, that we will prevent that happening going in the future. The most important issue, as you pointed out, is skills transfer between people who have been there like myself historically in this institution. I've been there now in my 16th year, and people who are coming in. And I think it's an important point that you've raised. And that's why I'm so concerned about the vacancies, because the fear in which people like myself, some of the more experienced people who will leave the institution and work with the newer people, is reduced all the time later they are appointed. So I think that the new people who will take over the institution, hopefully the people who've been appointed recently, like Mrs. Mizwai, who's one of our new members, full-time members, and the others who will succeed them, by our next generation of people who will take over. And I think it's an opportunity to actually transform the institution. You want to both bring in the new skills and have an opportunity for those of us who are moving out to share the experiences with the newer people coming in. I mean, the conversation that we often have in institutions, our cases are decided in panels, in each panel of years' case, but often people who are on the panel will say, look, this is an issue in my case, have we previously heard the matter, what did you do about it? And they will have a conversation with the more experienced people. You say, look, we had this case in the past, this is what we did, and the new people are free to agree or disagree with that approach, but they benefit from hearing that we've had something before that's not completely new and hearing that approach, and that's the best thing that we can do for people. So I think we must use this opportunity to have those people appointed and to see that they have an opportunity to work with the more experienced people. So far as the members' appointments are presidential appointments on the advice of the minister, so it's out of our hands directly to affect that process. And so far as our own staff is concerned, we make sure that they're representative around our case managers. Our case managers tend to be young lawyers, and they work for us for a couple of years, and they go elsewhere. They will either go to the Competition Commission, where a number of our people go, and still going to be quite happy with that, because sometimes we get people from the Commission and they come and work with us, so both institutions benefit, and sometimes people will get a good offer from the private sector. So we found that it's an attractive job for young people to come to, and they find this an attractive employer to come to get noticed by the profession and by the Commission. And so we are producing every year a number of people who we hope will be useful, but we lose them each year, but we accept that that's part of this particular job and we can train them.
Thank you very much. I guess we all expect to fight the competition issues, their performance for 2015 financial year, and what they're looking forward to in the coming year, already in the current financial year, already know. So we just want to congratulate them once more for the good audit outcome, the performance also, the non-financial performance, irrespective of the shortage of staff and also the other lesser resources. We also congratulate you for, we understand that your board member is working from home. And it's not a truth. When you visit the tree, you told us that, and you still emphasize on that, which is not enough. As I've stated, the CFO is here. I think the director, Michelle, is here. She will be able to raise the issues with herself. We'll also raise it again in our next. So that the speaker can formally forward it to the minister. We're hoping that the response will be good. Otherwise, let me thank you very much for coming and for your continuous good work. Thank other members, Lerato, and other members of your team. For the good work. We really appreciate the work you're doing and we're proud of it. We had those who went to the conference, we had how the professional is doing and seen how best we can handle any issue that arises. So far this. And how many countries are looking up to South Africa actually on competition measures. Otherwise, also members, may we thank you for your attendance and for your participation. Before you leave, yesterday I wanted to ask you, because we still have a little bit of time, the meeting is only at 3 o'clock, if we can use that time to those who are viewing the video, remember that we do the IDC Life Park. If you watch, you have instruction that can do that. The short video, and so that tomorrow you'll understand the work that they're doing around the food and the industry. Thank you very much. You may be excused.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
then she's given us a few months. Oh, yeah, thanks.
Yes.
Thank you.